Now, the digital revolution means there are more ways than ever to read. And yet a new survey finds the number of American teens reading for pleasure has dropped dramatically. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
For sure, Harry Potter and the Hunger Games haven't been big hits for nothing. Lots of teens and adolescents still do read a lot. But a roundup of studies put together by the nonprofit Common Sense Media shows a clear decline over time.
For example, 45% of 17-year-olds today say that they read for pleasure no more than 1 to 2 times a year, if that often.
That's way down from a decade ago, says Jim Steyer, head of Common Sense Media. Among 13-year-olds, a third say they read for pleasure only once or twice a year.
As a parent and an educator, this is a really big deal.
Steyer studies the impact of technology on children, and he finds the results striking, though not shocking. He has 4 kids and has seen the trend, mostly with his 16-year-old.
And I start to see it in our 10-year-old as well, because he is less and less reading. He's more and more attracted to some of the digital media platforms that he has access to and that he did not have access to when he was, say, 6 or 7 years old.
Now, the studies do not say kids are reading less because they're spending more time online. But Steyer's convinced that is at least part of the answer.
First of all, most children now have access to e-readers or other smart electronic devices like phones and tablets, and they're spending time on that. Numerous reports show the increasing use of new technology platforms by kids. It just strikes me as extremely logical that that's a big factor.
I don't really read for pleasure.
I don't read for pleasure either, unless it's for a school assignment.
Jamari Sidnor and Shamaka Anasike are 9th graders waiting for the bus outside Wilson High School in Washington, D.C. So how do they relax?
Generally, I talk on the phone or I watch like Netflix shows or Hulu shows, just like mostly TV, that's it.
I'm usually on my phone or watching TV too.
Of course, some students say they love to read but have too much homework or are swamped with sports. Researchers want to know more about how teens are spending their time in the digital age, but Catherine Zickier of the Pew Research Center says it's tricky. If a kid is looking at a book, you say, they're reading. But looking at a smartphone or tablet? Well, who knows?
And we've heard from middle and high school teachers that sometimes the internet is wonderful for highly motivated students to do deep and expansive research. But on the flip side, obviously, there are many distractions on the internet.
Despite those distractions, Jim Steyer of Common Sense Media says parents can still do a lot to promote reading.
Kids with parents who read, who buy or take books out of the library for their kids, and who then set time aside in their kid's daily schedule for reading, tend to read the most.
Whether it's on a book, an e-book, or some other gadget. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
American pornography is big business. Last year, the U.S. pornography industry brought in more than $5 billion in revenue, and the number of adult films released each year continues to dwarf the number of Hollywood releases. The promise of fast cash and fame draws young women to the industry. But most actresses do not get a cut of the royalties from the movies they star in. Many women who left porn have spoken out and said that producers and directors exploited or even abused them. Aza Akira has worked in the adult film industry for half a decade and is the author of a new memoir about her own experience. Akira is an outlier in the porn industry. The daughter of upper-middle-class parents who sent her to prep schools, Akira writes that unlike many young women, she didn't fall into sex work as a last resort. She chose it. Aza Akira, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You know, Aza, I know you've heard this. A lot of women who have left the industry say that it ruined them emotionally and financially. You know, Linda Lovelace, Shelley Lubin, other people. What do you say to that? Do you feel like you're putting a happy face on your own exploitation?
No, I mean, I knew it would ruin my life forever in the sense that, you know, I'll never be able to work with kids now. There's so many things I'll never be able to do. And I knew that. So I just wanted to really be sure that I was making the right choice. But I think some of the girls are definitely victims of certain kinds of circumstances, and they kind of just fell into porn, whether it be for money or, I don't know, a guy they met, just like a really unfortunate circumstance. And then I think there's also girls who have a great time doing porn, and then when they leave, sometimes they feel the need to justify what they've done. It's almost like reality sets in and, you know, you can't get a regular job. You don't have a resume. Society does shun you in a lot of ways. And I think they just need to flip the story to justify it.
But then there is that other side to it. Like, I mean, you used the phrase a little while ago, ruin my life forever. So it does. I mean, your book has kind of a happy cast about it. You come across pretty unconflicted about this. Is that true?
I do feel very unconflicted about it. I'm very confident that, like, I'm doing what I want to be doing. You know, when I said it ruins your life, I don't mean it in a way that I feel it ruined my life so much as I should have said it limits your life. And for me, I feel it's worth it.
Well, you know, and there are also people that just consider pornography as a category as something which is just inherently destructive, that there is, it is just by what it is, damaging to women.
I don't really see anything degrading about living out a sexual fantasy. I mean, I understand that, like, porn objectifies women, but I mean, it objectifies everyone in it, not just women. And I don't really see it as degrading at all. I see it as empowering.
But you don't think that women get degraded a lot more? Or things like, you know, think about race. Your ethnicity is fetishized, and you make money off of that. Don't you feel that that's destructive?
No, I don't see anything wrong with it. I mean, it's the reality of it. I signed up to be objectified and fetishized, and I am Asian. Why not capitalize on that?
Is there any dark side to the porn industry for you? Not even performers that might be exploited economically, at least?
I don't feel we're exploited at all. I mean, we're taken care of. I know that in porn, they used to make a lot more. I always hear about, like, the good old days when, you know, people were making like 40 grand a month. And it's definitely not like that anymore. But for me, I don't feel exploited. I'm living a very comfortable lifestyle. And to be honest, like, if porn were a regular paying job, if it just paid a regular salary like any other job, I would still do it. I can't speak for other people, obviously, but for me, the money is nice, but it's not even in, like, the top three reasons I do porn. And it's not lost on me that's not everyone.
For those women that come from more difficult circumstances, do you feel like the industry supports them once they get involved in the business?
I do feel the industry supports them in the sense that they get the financial care they need. I think some girls should not be in porn, for sure. There's definitely girls that are from harder backgrounds, and they should probably not be in porn. And it just comes down to whether you're in it for the right reason or not. I mean, that's a very subjective thing to say, mm-hmm. like, because obviously what I think are the right reasons are probably not what others think are the right reasons to be in porn. But, you know, when a girl is in it strictly for the money, I don't think it's worth it. No. I mean, like I said, it changes your whole life. It's your body. I don't think you should ever sell your body for just money. That's not worth it.
If you have kids, how would you feel about them going into the industry?
Having kids is something I'm really still conflicted about. And specifically how I will tell them. Sometimes I wonder if it's too late for me to have kids, not age-wise, but just, you know, my husband is in porn as well. And I think it would be a lot to put on a child. As far as would I be okay with them getting into porn, it's a really hard question, because if I knew in my heart that, say, my daughter was getting into porn for the same reason I was getting into porn, I would say definitely go for it. But how do you know that? You know, like, how would I know that she's in it for the right reasons, I guess you could say? It's definitely something I feel super conflicted about. There's no black and white answer.
Asa Akira's memoir about her life in the pornography industry is titled Insatiable, Porn, A Love Story. Asa, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
More documents become public this week on the operations of the National Security Agency. They will be published tomorrow in a book by Glenn Greenwald. He's one of the journalists who received classified material from contractor Edward Snowden. Greenwald calls his book No Place to Hide.
You know, nobody disputes that the NSA can be and should be trying to read the emails of Osama bin Laden and his collaborators. But the surveillance has gone so far beyond that, that motives, which are difficult to discern, I think are less important than the mere fact that this system has been built without our knowledge that has incredible dangers embedded within it and very few controls.
In his book, Greenwald tells a story on himself. When he started getting cryptic emails from a mysterious source, he repeatedly failed to follow up. The source turned out to be Edward Snowden. Greenwald nearly ignored him. An intermediary finally told Greenwald he needed to pay attention, and he's been mining the documents ever since. One newly published item says the NSA intercepted equipment like internet routers on its way to customers. The agency installed hardware to monitor communications pouring through. Snowden's acts and his flight to Hong Kong, then Russia, were hugely controversial, but U.S. officials have now conceded the need for change. And that raises a practical question we put to Greenwald. What kind of intelligence agencies we should have in a dangerous world? So let's talk about what kind of reform you would consider meaningful. And I don't mean tweaking the rules in some way, which is what seems to be discussed now, but suppose you had an opportunity to get in a room with people and talk about a U.S. intelligence agency or intelligence community that went after genuine bad guys, because you've acknowledged there are such people, while protecting people's privacy. What powers would you give that agency, and where would you draw the line as to what powers to deny it?
I think a great starting point for that question is what always used to happen prior to 9/11. Which is that the premise of the eavesdropping regime was that the U.S. government had all sorts of legitimate interests to eavesdrop on foreigners as well as Americans, but that history has proven that that power will be abused unless they first go to a court and get specific permission to target a particular individual because they've been able to present evidence that that person is somebody doing something that merits scrutiny. That system of individualized warrants and of specific judicial permission was enough for us to defend ourselves against the Soviet Union and all of its various appendages, against terrorist groups. That, to me, is really the fundamental question is, should we have a government that is monitoring and collecting and storing information about not individuals where there's evidence to believe they're engaged in wrongdoing, but entire populations who are guilty of nothing, and essentially suspicionless surveillance? And that, to me, is the key line. And if we return to that regime where the government can only read our emails or listen to our phone calls if they convince a court that we're doing something wrong that warrants surveillance, that would go a very long way, I think, toward balancing the need for security with the need for privacy.
Well, let me make sure I understand clearly what you're talking about, because when you say going back to the Cold War system, under the Cold War system, it's true that an American citizen or a U.S. person, as it's called, could not be surveilled upon without a warrant from a special court, at least in the latter part of the Cold War. But the rest of the world was essentially fair game. Are you saying that those rules would then be acceptable going forward for the United States as far as you're concerned?
Well, I mean, even under the FISA regime, the old FISA regime, and during the Cold War, if the U.S. government wanted to target a foreign target, they did need a warrant, actually, if that person was then going to talk to an American citizen. But you're right that they were fair game. But the difference was that back then, the capabilities were such that there was very limited surveillance that was permitted. What has changed now is the capability is so much greater because all of our communications are centralized on the internet and much more easily invaded. And so I do think we need much tighter restrictions on the ability of the U.S. government even to target foreign nationals, and should have to convince a court, probably with a lesser standard than for Americans, that there's a legitimate foreign surveillance or foreign intelligence rationale that is justifying the surveillance.
Help me figure that out a little more, because now you're saying not exactly constitutional protections for a German citizen or an Egyptian citizen, but something like that, the Fourth Amendment protection against search and seizure. You want something like that to apply to everyone in the world?
I don't think it's a constitutional protection, because foreign nationals on foreign soil don't actually have the protections of the Constitution, as the Supreme Court has ruled. I think it's a prudential consideration. I mean, we have policies, for example, that restrict how the U.S. government can kill foreign nationals, even though they don't have the rights of due process. I think that we ought to have a regime in place that limits the extent to which they can spy on foreign nationals. And in fact, you know, even under the law now, theoretically, there are limits on even how they can spy on foreign nationals. They're not supposed to be able to just spy on whoever they want as long as they're a foreign citizen. They're supposed to confine themselves to people who are agents of a foreign power or of a terrorist organization or otherwise where there's legitimate foreign intelligence value to be obtained through the surveillance. They just don't have any oversight to enforce those standards. So I'm not really proposing the existence of limitations where none now exist. I'm simply proposing that if we have those limitations, that they be taken seriously by forcing the NSA to go to an outside independent body and justify the surveillance.
When we have spoken with U.S. intelligence agencies, they have struggled to find any terrorist plot that they've really disrupted using these mass surveillance programs. They've struggled to find the value of the mass surveillance programs and document anything particularly worthwhile that they've done with them. Let me ask you the opposite question, though. Are you able to document anyone who has been actively harmed by the National Security Agency, someone whose life was destroyed, for example, by information getting into the hands of that agency?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's information, there's documents in the book that talk about how they have collected the online sexual activities of people that they consider radical, who they say are not terrorists, not involved in terrorist organizations or plots, simply disseminating messages they think are radical and plotting how to use that information to disclose it and to publicly destroy their reputation. There's still reporting that we're doing about individual people who have been targeted and emails that have been read. You know, I think that if you look at what happened in the 60s and 70s with the COINTELPRO abuses and the like, it wasn't so much that they were gathering information and then destroying people's lives. It was that by monitoring people in such a systematic way, they were chilling core political liberties. And that, I think, is the same kind of harm that we're seeing today.
So you document that they are gathering a lot of information that would make a lot of people feel uncomfortable. Did the NSA act on that information and actually go after people?
We don't have the evidence in what Mr. Snowden provided us about whether they followed through on these plans that they were creating in the documents to use online activities to blackmail people or ruin their reputations or otherwise coerce and threaten them. But there's still a lot more reporting that we're doing on that exact question of what has the NSA been doing with the information they've been gathering, who have they been targeting, and for what reasons.
Is that where your reporting is going next?
Absolutely, yes.
Glenn Greenwald, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
He is, of course, a journalist who received documents from Edward Snowden, and his new book is No Place to Hide. This is NPR News.
In my life, I use a lot of black and white, so I say I hate books about creativity.
You might recognize that voice if you've seen the documentary Man on Wire. It's Philippe Petit, famous for illegally walking the high wire between the World Trade Center towers in 1974. He didn't just walk between the towers, though. As one of the officers who nabbed him afterwards said, he danced. Petit has performed and lectured all over the world, hoping to inspire people to take creative risks. That's the motive behind his new book, Creativity, the Perfect Crime, even though he hates books about creativity.
But actually, it's about my creativity, and it's a very different thing.
There are helpful notes about practicing and organizing your thoughts, but the book is more like a chaotic peek into Petit's brain, with sketches, meditative asides, and even internal dialogue written out.
Because it is personal, it will be useful, because I'm not doing any rules. This is not a thesis on creativity. This is a kind of an outlaw confession. My journey has always been the balance between chaos and order. I have not followed the right path. I have been expelled from 5 different schools when I was a kid, and I learned basically all what I do by myself. So I have something to say that rarely is being said.
You often refer to this criminal aspect. You talk about the artist, the creative individual, being in some ways like a criminal, yourself being like a criminal. Could you explain that?
From an early age, I differentiated myself from the other kids because I like things well done. I was trying to orient myself toward perfection, and I was very individualist. And then the more I adopted the faces of a criminal, of course, an artistic criminal, the more I felt that the world was against me, that I had to tiptoe, that I had to hide my discoveries. And of course, it's a metaphor, but to me, the real creativity, the full creativity, has to be rebellious, maybe not unlawful, but outlaws of the laws that we have created. To be able to create fully, it's maybe fine that you learn the rules, but you have to forget and to rebel against those rules.
But you also break down, even though there are similarities between what you do in a bank heist, there's a fundamental difference.
Well, yes, in a bank heist, you steal, you take away. In an illegal highway walk, you bring, you give a gift of beauty and of inspiration. It's not me who says that, it's my audience. You know, after a walk, they come and they say, you have changed my life. Now I can move mountains. Thank you.
In writing about creativity, you talk about how to engage with the world and engage with objects differently. You talk about parkour. For people who aren't familiar with parkour, that's this sort of intense running where people kind of almost like run up along the sides of buildings from rooftop to rooftop. I thought that was a pretty recent thing, but you did it as a kid.
Yes, my father was a very athletic man, and he took us, his kids, me and my sister, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, in the woods every Sunday and do a parkour. But yes, it started in France many, many years ago, and I'm glad that this action has taken over the world.
Well, there's also something about the transgressive quality, the trespassing quality, that seems to attract you.
Yes. Any activity such as parkour, such as wire walking, any art that will rejoice in a rebellious freedom is something that is going to enrich our lives.
And again, even with that rebellious freedom, you know, it's very interesting how you balance that with this intense planning, the mental dress rehearsals that you go through. How do you know when you're kind of done with the dreaming phase and you have to start the engineering part?
Well, it's not so much knowing, it's the hours of the day dictate that to you. There is usually a deadline, there is a time of a performance, and if you're not ready, well, that's going to be very tough. So as you said, first I am the daydreamer and the poet who conceive of a performance, and at some point I have to, pull my sleeves off and become the rigger who actually rigs the wire. And at some point, very soon thereafter, comes the moment where I need to turn the page again and I become the performer. And it's very difficult for me to switch from one to another of those three phases because they overlap. At some point, I have to wash my hands from pulling the greasy cable and then put my costume and appear on stage and think of doing a beautiful walk.
You've been performing for a long time. Has it become any easier to you over time, or has the process changed for you?
You see, the beauty for me of performing a lifetime, I've been performing in the street for more than 50 years, magic, basically 60 years, and the high wire, 45 years. The beauty of it is that it's never the same, it's never easy, and yet part of my art is to make it look easy. Since I was not born in the circus, I'm not trying to impress people with a somersault and tricks and pyramids. So I cultivated, and it took a lifetime, the art of walking. And walking is the hardest thing in the world. It's like breathing. You know, we take it for granted, but we should go to school for breathing and walking. And there is nothing more difficult, but I should say also nothing more easy than walking. So I love that. I love the difficulty of showing how easy it is.
And you also think that there should be a course on mistakes in school.
Oh, yes. I have a long list of what there should be a course of, lock picking, mistakes. I have discovered that my best teachers were my mistakes. And instead of covering a mistake with a list of excuses, I actually unwrap the mistake and I look at it and I approach it and I see why. Why did I cut myself with a saw? I didn't sharpen the saw correctly. I was saying hello to a friend passing by and not concentrating. Or maybe the wood was wet. I didn't inspect the wood. It's my fault, and that's how I'm going to learn. So I love mistakes, yes.
So what are you working on now? What's right now in the filing cabinets, on the index cards and the notebooks?
Many, many things. Well, I am very proud of this book on creativity, which, by the way, for me as an author, is my 10th book. I am working on films. I'm working on High Wire Crossing. For example, the 40th anniversary of my work at the World Trade Center is this year, August 7th. So I have in my sleeve a little aerial apparition that I would like to share with the New Yorkers and with the world. I continue to be a street juggler. I have many projects, and I guess that keeps me young.
That's Philippe Petit. His latest book is Creativity, The Perfect Crime. Thank you, and can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you very much.
Timothy Geithner was president of the New York Federal Reserve when the Wall Street bank Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008. A few months later, he'd become President Obama's Treasury Secretary, the crisis deepening on his watch. He takes it all on in a new book out today called Stress Test. He details one crisis after another, helping to engineer the unwinding of Lehman, Bear Stearns, and the nation's biggest thrift, Washington Mutual, to name a few. Geithner sat down to talk about his thought process during that time with my colleague, Robert Siegel.
Timothy Geithner acknowledges the deeply mixed reviews he got as Treasury Secretary. Wall Street types take him for a crypto-socialist champion of excessive government intervention and regulation. Occupy Wall Street types take him for a tool of the banks. Geithner sees himself as a guy who was trying to get the financial system out of a multifaceted crisis with the threat of a Great Depression looming.
You know, it's like you're in the cockpit of the plane. Your engine's burning. Smoke's filling the cabin. It's filled with a bunch of people that are fighting with each other about who's responsible. You have terrorists on the plane, and people want you to come out of the cockpit and, you know, put them in jail. And you have to land the plane. That terrifying core objective in a crisis is to make sure you first put out the fire.
There's a moment in the book when you give vent to a sentiment that you more typically dismiss as an Old Testament urge to punish. And you write this: I used to joke that there would be less moral hazard if financial executives had to put up their own homes as collateral ahead of assets of their firms. And you describe walking past an oceanfront mansion of a former head of Bear Stearns, the bankrupt Wall Street firm, and saying, that one should have been the first loss. Isn't that exactly what your critics on the left felt and still feel?
Well, people on the right and the left both believe that there was a way to save the country from disaster and still let the system fall apart, impose losses on creditors. But in a financial panic, as we saw in 08, it's the opposite of what makes sense to protect people. In some sense, the paradox of this is the only way to reduce damage to the innocent victims of a crisis is to make sure you keep the lights on. Because if you don't keep the lights on in the financial system, then you're going to face depression-level unemployment. That's the paradox of it.
You describe the collapse of Washington Mutual, the nation's biggest thrift at the time, as, and I quote, one of the least appreciated episodes of the crisis, and one in which, you write, the U.S. government made things worse. Your antagonist in that case was the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair. What did she do that struck you as so wrong?
Well, I want to do this in the fairest way, and that was a terrible mistake, and it was a completely avoidable mistake, because in that moment, even though the crisis was at its most, the country was at its most perilous state, and the panic was gaining momentum. In that context, what the FDIC did is use the normal playbook, and they gave that bank to another bank for a very cheap price and impose losses or haircuts on the creditors of Washington Mutual. And what that happened, and it happened within a matter of minutes, it was like adding fuel to the fire. And that fire that was already burning bright and hot spread to imperil in a matter of days some of the much stronger banks across the country.
You're saying because the creditors of Washington Mutual were forced to settle for a lot less than 100 cents on the dollar.
Just to be fair. And to Sheila Bair's credit and the credit of her colleagues at the FDIC, they reversed course very quickly.
But you were very critical of her at the time. You are in the book. In Andrew Ross Sorkin's article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Sheila Bair returns the favor. Sorkin quotes her as saying of your policies, putting up walls of money to restore faith in the banks, Tim had no idea whether the government's money would be lost. Taxpayers will never be adequately compensated for the tremendous risks he took with their money. Did you actually have an idea that the government's money would not be lost and that this was safe?
We didn't, you know, we didn't do this with the expectation we would make money for the taxpayer. We did it with the knowledge that only by taking risks the market wouldn't take were we be in a position to prevent mass unemployment on a global scale. And that knowledge was informed by the judgment and the record of history. Now, the fact that we earned a return on the rescue, well over $100 billion, of course does not compensate people for the damage caused by the crisis. Of course it couldn't. And it couldn't. There's no way it could. But if we hadn't designed the rescue as forcefully, and of course what Sheila Bair did at the FDIC was part of that rescue, we would have left people with much more damage and much more damage to the country.
But these haircuts for Washington Mutual's creditors, which you describe as adding fuel to the fire, annoyed you so much. Later on, the government bailed out the auto companies, and I remember Chrysler bondholders, I believe it was, claiming that their rights were being trampled when they took haircuts in the accelerated bankruptcy. They lost. It worked. Life went on. It didn't fuel any greater fire.
Excellent question. And, you know, it's just that this is the core hard thing we don't like to admit, and it seems unfair. But, you know, banks are different. They're different because their existence depends on, in a way that's different from any other industry, their ability to convince people to keep their money in the bank. And when they lose that ability, then they cannot function. And when they can't function, as you saw in the wake of Lehman and Washington Mutual, what they have to do is liquidate assets at that terrible loss, and that adds fuel to the fire.
But when you speak of the unique thing about banks, I'm reminded of the Wall Street veteran Felix Rohatyn once telling me that he came from the times when banks were in the business of conserving wealth, protecting wealth, not creating wealth. It seems that the banking sector, that it was there before you became head of the New York Fed, the banking sector as it now exists puts its credibility on the line all the time by creating things like synthetic collateral debt obligations, exotic instruments that sometimes the banks themselves don't even understand. So they've increased the risk of loss of credibility by that standard.
I think you should think about this slightly differently. Mm-hmm. This was not a crisis caused by financial innovation on a massive scale. It wasn't a crisis caused fundamentally by a set of new fancy things that in retrospect seemed very risky. It was a crisis caused because we had a long period of confidence that it was safe to lend a lot of money, safe to borrow a lot of money relative to income, that your house prices would never fall, that recessions would be short and shallow. No memory of panic, no memory of depression. And what happened in that environment was that people ended up taking too much risk.
No, you argue that in the book, that these were old-fashioned causes behind the collapse.
In fancy new forms.
But my reaction was, it's like saying I got robbed because I forgot to lock the door in my house. It's a simple old-fashioned reason. But if the lock, on my house is some kind of a combination lock where you have to solve three quadratic equations to lock the door, I've hugely increased the risk of leaving my door unlocked. And it seemed to me that the complexity and the what passed for innovation, I just can't, in my own mind, eliminate it from responsibility the way you
did. Let me try it this way, see if this is more convincing. What happened in our financial system before the crisis was, over a period of decades, the system outgrew, found a way around all the safeguards we put in place after the Great Depression. And we allowed this whole new set of risky institutions to grow and build and become massive and huge. And to prevent that risk, all you need to do, mm-hmm. and I'm saying, I'm trying to reduce to a simple thing,
right.
Maybe I'm making your point, is force that set of core institutions to hold thicker shock absorbers against the risk of loss, because you cannot know what the future brings.
But I think a skeptic would say, we did this. We made the securities that way. Would say, actually, they did. The people who were issuing the securities managed to get all the regulations changed in their favor to make the financial sector exactly what it was at the beginning.
But it's an understandable perception given the scale of innovation. But the vital, critical, decisive problem was a more simple problem, which is people did not anticipate the risk that house prices might fall. We could face a bad recession, and that might induce a financial panic.
One of the first things you write about was your maiden speech as Treasury Secretary, and you write, this is your own judgment, quote, "it sucked," unquote. I've spoken with Henry Paulson, who preceded you as Treasury Secretary, and he recalls He says his greatest regret is having been unable to persuade people that what Washington did wasn't to help banks, it was to help people. Why such poor communication?
Well, I wasn't hired to be the communications guy, and I wasn't good at it. I don't think anybody found a way to in that moment to explain or describe it. And I think that's because, at its core, the things we had to do were going to look like we were rewarding the arsonist. And it is, I think, impossible to expect a normal human to explain to them that the only way to protect them from that risk was to reward the people who had taken a lot of risk with their money. And I think at its core, that's why governments typically do a terrible job in financial crises.
You were the most unlikely of Treasury secretaries by resume, not a banker, not a politician or a corporate CEO, not an economist. What makes a good Treasury secretary?
It sort of depends on the moment, I think. And I tell the story in the book about when I first met him and he told me he might have to ask me to come to Washington.
President Obama, then Senator Obama.
I tried very hard to talk him out of it because I felt at that time that there were better choices and that I was already so up to my neck in the choices we'd already made that I was very proud of, that I wouldn't distance myself from, would complicate his capacity to try to rebuild confidence.
Things that you had been part of at the New York Fed.
Yeah, because we'd already at that point done a set of necessary things to try to break the panic that were what fed this deep sense of unfairness. My view was if he, understanding my weaknesses and my experience, asked me to do it, when your president asks you to do that in a moment of crisis, then you say yes to that.
What did he say in response to your eloquent explanation of why you weren't the man for the job?
He seemed unmoved. He seemed unmoved by that. And I failed to communicate again. It was just a failure of communication, typical thing for me. But I am kind of like, I feel so lucky he asked me to do it, and I so admire him.
Well, Timothy Geithner, a former Secretary of the Treasury and author now of Stress Test, Reflections on Financial Crises, thanks a lot for talking with us again.
Thank you, Robert.
And you can read an excerpt of Geithner's new memoir at npr.org.